Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What happened? A simple question, but President Obama says he doesn't have all the answers yet about that Christmas Day air scare.
We need to determine just how the suspect was able to bring dangerous explosives aboard an aircraft and what additional steps we can take to thwart future attacks.
One thing we do know, air travel just got a lot more complicated again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the Kirby bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this 28th of December. You could almost hear the collective groans from holiday air travelers who found themselves confined to their seats with nothing in their laps for the last hour of their flights the past few days as a result of that failed attempt to bomb a Northwest Airlines flight bound for Detroit Christmas Day. President Obama was supposed to be vacationing in Hawaii, but said today he's been staying on top of things.
I directed that we take immediate steps to ensure the safety of the traveling public. We made sure that all flights still in the air were secure and could land safely. We immediately enhanced screening and security procedures for all flights, domestic and international.
The head of Homeland Security concedes the safety net failed. And now it seems we're all going to pay in one way or another, although airline officials were hinting today those onerous in-flight rules are being eased somewhat. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
The Transportation Security Administration says domestic travelers won't notice many changes, but people flying into the United States from other countries could face longer waits at the airport, extra security screenings, and pat-downs. Pilots will have the discretion to limit the use of laptops and other electronics for portions of the flight. Richard Gritta teaches airline finance at the University of Portland in Oregon. He says the restrictions could put off the airline's most lucrative passengers, business travelers.
Business people like hands-on, being there, physically being present. But if it gets to be too much of a hassle, you could see a reduction in air travel, especially on the shorter haul flights for that reason.
That could hurt the airlines, which lost more than $23 billion last year. At least one airline is already feeling the effects. Air Canada has had to cancel some flights to the U.S. because of security delays. But Shane Downey with the National Business Travel Association downplays any long-term impact on his industry.
No matter how good the technology becomes for video conferencing or whatnot, it's still not the same as sitting down and working with that person or that company across the table.
As one industry consultant put it, 30 years ago, people thought the fax machine would kill business travel. But if flying commercial becomes much more of a headache, he says more people may turn to train travel for short trips or to private business jets. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Americans delivered a big bah humbug to the recession to the tune of $250 million at the box office over the weekend. We need no reminder the economy isn't so hot, but ticket sales definitely are. Apparently what we need is an escape. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Higher ticket prices in recent years have led some analysts to predict that movies may no longer be recession resistant. Guess again, says Carl DiOrio, deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
The skeptics were proven wrong once again. It turns out that going to the movies is a pretty good deal in most consumers' minds.
The sci-fi extravaganza Avatar remained the top draw for the second weekend in a row. Where Avatar is shown in 3D, some cinemas are charging premium ticket prices, which has helped bolster box office receipts. In other theaters, an English detective has proven enduringly popular.
Sherlock Holmes.
Paul DeGarabedian follows box office trends for Hollywood.com, a website devoted to movie news.
Sherlock Holmes not only posted a record-breaking opening weekend, it also set the record for a Christmas Day debut with about $25 million.
Families turned out also mostly to watch those annoying chipmunks.
Oh, relax. Who's sleeping? Rabbit Singing Chipmunks.
DiOrio with The Hollywood Reporter says that Alvin and the Chipmunks 2, The Squeakquel, appears set to earn $200 million domestically.
Hate to say it, but we may be seeing a third Chipmunks movie at some point at this rate.
With no new movies opening this week and many people still on vacation, movie theaters are expecting their good run to continue. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wall Street liked the turnout at the malls this holiday shopping season. We'll check the results when we do the numbers. Can you guess which country is the world's leading exporter? Until this past year, the correct answer would have been Germany. But over the past weekend, a top official predicted the Germans have likely been toppled from that spot by China. That prediction was made by a Chinese official. This decade, Chinese exports have grown an average of 25% a year. That's twice as fast as Germany. That growth rate isn't a huge surprise, considering China is the one country that it seems was barely rattled by the economic turmoil of 2009. To take a look back at the year and a bit forward to 2010, Marketplace's Scott Tong joins me now.
Hello, Bob.
So from here, it sure feels like China's emerged unscathed or relatively unscathed. Does it feel that way from there?
It feels pretty good, but it depends who you talk to in China. Let me just tell you a story about my distant cousin who was raised in China, lives in Shanghai. He's a factory manager at a General Motors factory where they make cars for the China market, and he works about 29 days every month because China is now the world's largest auto market. It's going to pass the U.S. this year. But his dad, my distant uncle, is hurting because he's a consultant to a factory that exports stuff to America, power drills and that kind of stuff. So what you have is China's domestic economy is roaring and it's compensating for a really ugly global economy. And if you do the math, put it together, most think China is going to grow at about 8% and change. So as China keeps growing, the multinational American companies keep coming and planting the flag here. The latest one is Krispy Kreme donuts, Bob. So I suppose it's our sign that China's transition to a free market economy is hereby complete.
Watch your waist, Scott.
There you go.
Why did China shake off this so quickly, having said what you just told us?
Well, quickly is the word. Early in the year, the Chinese government rolled out this $585 billion stimulus package. And it sure helps when you have an authoritarian government that doesn't have to worry about filibusters or Senate minority leaders getting in the way of progress. So that money flowed quickly into the economy through bank loans. And here's the difference between Chinese bankers and American bankers, where the American banker will assess risk and all that. The Chinese banker will look at that a little bit. But here, if you're a banker at a state-owned bank and the state, the government, tells you to lend to a state-owned company, well, let me think about it. Yes, your loan is approved. So that money went quickly into infrastructure, incentives for consumers to buy things like cars and appliances and computers. And so we have 8% growth.
So all this lending, too much of a good thing? That's where the housing bubble came from in the U.S. after all.
One economist calls it crazed money. So what we're hearing is worries now about a bunch of things that come with easy money. Tick the box that says inflation, bad loans, an asset bubble. Property prices are perhaps topic number one among middle-class Chinese these days because housing is very unaffordable. I mean, the soap opera that everyone's watching is called Snail House because that's the size of the home that a lot of people can afford is this itty-bitty home right now. So we will see next year how all these howevers play out in the economy.
Well, spin this forward a bit for us. What kind of world can we expect with China in the next year?
Well, we will hear a lot more cases of Chinese outbound investment, Chinese money going everywhere in the world. And where is it going to go? Well, you know, it's going to be buying parts of sports teams. A Chinese investor is about to finish buying a small fraction of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Chinese solar energy companies are going to set up plants in the U.S. There's talk of a Marshall Plan. Beijing and the World Bank are talking about giant amounts of loans to Africa. So all of this will happen, and we'll hear about that. And for Americans, what this outside investment could do to help is it could help the stock market. It could help U.S. companies float that would otherwise go under with this Chinese investment money. What we may hear less of from China is the constant drone of China being America's banker, America's banker, America's banker. Because the more Americans save, they're actually buying more American bonds than the Chinese are.
Marketplace's Scott Tong with the view from Shanghai. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
All right, Bob.
It was pretty easy to become overwhelmed with all that's happened in the past year. Between financial bailouts and health care reform, 2009 had plenty of headlines to digest. But of course, that wasn't all of it. A lot of other things happened that didn't get the same kind of attention. So we asked a few of our regular commentators to muse on some of those stories. Justin Wolfers points to a report from the French government on gross domestic product, which may have underestimated how powerful a measure the GDP really is.
When French President Sarkozy became frustrated with measures of economic performance, he responded as any French leader would. He commissioned a panel to investigate. Sarkozy's commission noted an array of problems with gross domestic product, or GDP. It can grow despite, or even because, pollution is rising, families are falling apart, and violence is escalating. On the flip side, GDP can stagnate as people stop to smell the roses, enjoy more time with friends, and spend less time engaged in GDP-enhancing work. Bobby Kennedy famously argued that GDP, quote, measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. The concern is that if policymakers target what we measure rather than what is worthwhile, we'll be led astray. It's an important point, at least in theory. But in practice, gross domestic product has been a remarkable indicator of the health of nations. Betsy Stevenson and I have recently analysed data across over 140 countries from the new Gallup World Poll. In countries with greater GDP per capita, have people who are more satisfied and more likely to report experiencing enjoyment, daily laughter, and being treated with respect. If you live in a high GDP country, you're less likely to feel pain, depression, or boredom on any given day. Beyond these subjective measures, higher GDP also corresponds with more education and increased life expectancy. In theory, these things aren't counted in GDP. But in practice, the GDP indices paint roughly the same picture as very broad measures of a country's well-being, like the UN's Human Development Index. And even in this past tumultuous year, the GDP data have given the right signals. The stagnation in GDP that you read about in the business pages is just as evident in the happiness data. I have mixed feelings about the argument I'm making. I agree with the Sarkozy Commission that the official statistics have problems, and no economist would suggest a dogged pursuit of growing GDP at any cost. But it's worth remembering that on the whole, GDP provides a useful barometer of our economic health. And I'm hoping we'll finally see that barometer turn up in 2010.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Post your thoughts on the year's undercovered news. Our website is marketplace.org. A little over a week ago, there was a meeting of tourism ministers from eight Arab nations. They gathered to discuss the effects of the global financial crisis on travel in their region. Today, they've got more to worry about now that Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for that failed air attack over the weekend and called for an all-out war on crusaders. Lately, though, tourism has been booming in Syria. Growing numbers of foreign visitors are flocking to the capital's old city, the ancient walled quarter of Damascus with its many historic buildings. It was once seen as a rundown slum. Now it's a treasure hunting ground for prospective hoteliers. From Damascus, Don Duncan reports.
The Four Seasons Hotel in Damascus is an impressive symbol of the city's newfound consumerism. 18 stories high and the hub of a new commercial zone that attracts thousands of Syrian shoppers. Increasing numbers of foreigners, too. The Four Seasons is a weather vane for Syria's buoyant tourism industry.
It's growing very well. It's up between 20 and 25% each year.
Marwan Akush runs a hotel consultancy and reservation service in Damascus. He says big statement hotels like the Four Seasons are great. But there's another more discreet indicator of the tourism boom in the ancient narrow streets of the old city. Large traditional houses are being converted into hotels. Each has between 6 and 12 rooms. They're furnished with antiques and built around a shared internal courtyard. Already 15 have sprung up in the old city and more are planned.
In fact, we have almost 30 to 35 projects coming within the coming 5 years.
The region is now relatively stable politically and Syria's economy is opening up. Visitors want an authentic Middle Eastern experience, and this was at the top of hotelier Sami Mamoun's mind when he opened The Old Vine, Damascus's third boutique hotel, in 2007.
So it's like saying you're going to Rome to see the Colosseum, and you're staying in a hotel inside the Colosseum, because they come to Damascus to see Old Damascus. So why not just live and stay and sleep in Old Damascus and experience it?
In Damascus's old city, property values for intact traditional houses are rising quickly, and a lack of space and hotel rooms in the old city means occupancy rates, particularly for hotels with a bit of character, are invariably high.
There is no more low season in Damascus or in Syria.
But word of this investment opportunity is spreading. Other businessmen are now scouring Old Damascus for the remaining limited number of properties suitable for refurbishment. A few alleyways away from Mamoun's Old Vine Hotel, work is in full swing on the Aganor, a 12-room boutique hotel slated to open next year. Investor Yazin Al-Ghawri is putting in some $6 million. He expects a return on investment within 6 years, and he's optimistic that his property's value will increase.
If you buy something in the Old Damascus for $500,000, in 1 year, the price will go up to in like 40%, 50%.
Despite all this frenetic speculation, investment and construction behind the scenes, the streets of Old Damascus remain serene. The sequestered boutique hotels even more so. And that's what keeps tourists like American William Hardin coming here.
The minute I saw it, the minute I was welcomed, the intimacy of it, the friendliness of it, I said, this is my home.
I'm Don Duncan for Marketplace.
Coming up, a group of squatters is costing the Catholic Church big time.
We probably did not expect that it would be 5 years. But Cardinal Sean made the commitment to do nothing, really, until the appeal process had been completed.
But first, let's do the numbers. Light trading today, the Dow Industrials picked up 0.25%, or 26 points, to end at 10,547. The NASDAQ also picked up 0.25%, 5 points, to finish at 2291. The S&P 500 gained 0.1%, 1 point, to close at 1127. The Treasury Department said it will give the quasi-governmental mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as much money as they need for the next 3 years. Fannie shares jumped around 21%, Freddie rocketed up nearly 27%. Macy's and Walmart each spruced up around 1% after news that consumer spending ticked up in November and December. Online sales rose more than 15%. That buoyed Amazon.com by 0.6%. The web retailer said more people bought e-books than hard copies for the first time ever on Christmas Day. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index, letting us know how we all feel about spending money. On December 29, 1999, the NASDAQ broke 4,000 for the first time. And Emmy Award-winning actress Patricia Clarkson turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. The economy might still be plodding along slowly, but many businesses are acting like times are flush. At least that's what you get from filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. We've called Michelle Leader for help combing through the fine print of those statements. She runs footnoted.org, a website that explores the fine prints full time. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
So you're running a contest to vote for what you call the worst disclosures in SEC filings. What are some of the doozies you found so far?
You know, it was actually there was a lot to choose from this year. And so far, we've asked our readers to vote. And what's in first place right now is a disclosure by Chesapeake Energy that they paid $12.1 million to purchase its CEO's antique map collection. That's gotten okay. about 40% of the votes so far, so it's in the lead.
And I understand that Martha Stewart is on the list as well?
Yeah, Martha Stewart is too. She got a $3 million retention bonus to stay at the company that is called Martha Stewart Omnimedia.
Hold on. Where else is she going to go?
Brand X? I don't know.
Well, if your company's doing well, though, is there any harm in some of these perks?
I think if your company is doing well, but I don't think that's essentially the case at either of these two companies, nor, you know, another one that we highlighted here was Freddie Mac, which, you know, has taken over $50 billion in government aid, and they signed up a new CFO and gave him a $1.5 million signing bonus. I mean, this isn't the Yankees here. This is, you know, a company that's in deep trouble.
Well, I suppose it's possible that they buy the company's argument that these signing bonuses, in the case of Freddie Mac, for example, are necessary to get and keep the talent.
I think that's certainly the argument there. But, you know, given the number of CFOs that are out there on the market, you would think that you wouldn't have to pay $1.5 million to attract one.
You ran this contest last year as well. Have you seen any changes in the types or the number of these disclosures?
Not really. We've been running the contest actually for the past 3 years. And, you know, we've actually in the past we had picked the footnote, the best footnote ourselves. But 3 years ago, we decided to turn it over to our readers. And it seems that, you know, crazy perks definitely garner the most votes or the most anger from readers. So last year it was a company that disclosed that they had allowed their CEO to purchase a fishing camp. And then the year before that was Quest, the telecommunications company, which had negotiated with their CEO to allow him to allow his stepdaughter to fly the corporate jet back and forth to high school. So kind of ridiculous perks, it seems to get readers' attention.
Well, you say your readers are angry, but is this kind of public shaming going to succeed at all? What's the answer here?
I don't know what the answer is. I mean, perhaps, you know, if companies weren't burying this stuff deep in SEC filings that they thought nobody was reading and had to publicize it a little bit more, maybe it wouldn't happen as often as it did.
But what's your best guess? Is this going to change or is it going to continue?
No, I think it's probably going to continue.
But I guess that's good news for you, because if they changed, you'd be out of business, right?
I would be out of business, wouldn't I? And then what would I do with all my time other than read SEC filings?
Well, if you'd like to cast your vote for the worst disclosure of 2009, head to Michelle's website, footnoted.org. Michelle Leader, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
Back in 2004, the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston decided to close and sell 70 churches after it had to pay more than $141 million to settle sex abuse lawsuits. But parishioners at five of those churches refused to leave. And they're still there. They're not holding formal services. They're just squatting 24/7. The stalemate has ended up costing the Archdiocese more than $500,000 a year. And as Monica Brady Meyerhoff reports from WBUR, that price tag could get steeper.
If you look along the walls,
Mary Ellen Rogers shows off five handmade quilts hanging near the altar of St. Francis Cabrini Church in Scituate, a town 30 miles south of Boston. Each quilt marks a year that a group of parishioners has been occupying the building illegally.
They represent who we are. Our third anniversary quilt is called the Journey Quilt. And it's a road. It's a road to the church. There's bridges that we want to build, the bridges with the Archdiocese of Boston.
She and her husband, John, are two leaders of the sit-in, or vigil, as they call it. They coordinate more than 100 people in shifts of two to stay in the church day and night. John Rogers is surprised the sit-ins here and at other churches are still going on.
I thought it would be done within the year.
The Archdiocese probably wishes it had been. It's paying $600,000 a year to keep the buildings insured and provide the squatters with heat, electricity, and other services. Local church leaders say it's only right to pay those costs, while the Vatican weighs appeals from parishioners to keep the churches open. Sister Marian Batho works with the head of the Boston Archdiocese, Cardinal Sean O'Malley.
We probably did not expect that it would be 5 years, but Cardinal Sean made the commitment to do nothing, really, until the appeal process had been completed.
The church is also paying an additional $700,000 for nearly 25 other closed churches that have either not sold or are also the target of formal appeals to remain open. If that wasn't headache enough, the archdiocese could soon be paying more than maintenance costs if local officials get their way. The town of Scituate has slapped the archdiocese with a bill for nearly $150,000 in back taxes. To the town's way of thinking, the archdiocese no longer considers St. Francis Church a holy sanctuary. Therefore, the building should no longer be exempt from local property taxes. Jason Tallerman is a lawyer for the town.
No one's above the tax code. And when it comes to providing a teacher for your kids or that necessary firefighter or for salt for the roads, we need money. And it is the equivalent of a full-salaried teacher.
The archdiocese wouldn't comment on the tax issue. It has paid the taxes into an escrow account while it fights the move. In court filings, the archdiocese maintains the churches should still be considered tax-exempt until the Vatican rules on their fate. Meanwhile, other towns around Boston have sent their own tax bills, totaling more than $130,000. The archdiocese is fighting those in court, too. The Vatican could rule on the disputed churches in the Boston Archdiocese as early as this spring. Peter Bore leads an organization that supports the closed parishes. He suspects market forces, as much as Vatican bureaucracy, have delayed a final decision on the disputed churches.
Given the condition of the real estate market yesterday, today, and probably tomorrow, these properties cannot be sold readily.
The squatters at St. Francis Cabrini say they have enough money to buy the church, but the archdiocese doesn't seem interested. The cardinal has not met with leaders of the sit-in since last year. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, AT&T has resumed internet sales of the popular iPhone in the New York City area. For reasons the carrier won't clearly explain, they were suspended over the weekend, spurring speculation AT&T was trying to discourage sales in New York because it doesn't have enough cell sites to handle demand. A writer for the Consumerist website reports she was told by an online sales rep that, quote, New York is not ready for the iPhone. But the AP reports AT&T might also have been trying to curb fraudsters who buy the phones to sell them on eBay. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 0.25% or 26 points. The Nasdaq bumped up 0.25%, 5 points. The S&P 500 added 0.1% or 1 point. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program, who small businesses are looking for to help them create more jobs.
Somebody who will answer the phones, do filing, do accounting. I mean, they're trying to pinch and hold four jobs into one and pay less.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.